Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's time now for War Telescope, a presentation of the News and Special Events Department of NBC. But first, your government asks you to consider this point. The American public has in its possession today billions of dollars which can either start a depression or win the war. In wartime, family incomes are up and the amount of goods that can be bought is down. Therefore, after all necessary buying has been done, the average person has a lot of money left over. If he starts to bid for scarce items with this extra leftover money, he will push prices upward and will start disastrous inflation. To keep prices down, there must be planned spending. That means buying only that is necessary. And there must be planned savings. That means putting that extra money in a bank and insurance in war bonds. Let's all get this habit of minimum spending and maximum saving. Now for the War Telescope, we'll take you first to NBC in Paris.
This is Paul Archinard in Paris. General de Gaulle held a press conference for the first time since last September this afternoon. As the general explained, he wanted to clear up the French position on the Syrian question. He desired to clear up certain news reports which he called erroneous, and first of all, pointed out that one plane and a battery of cannon were the only material used in quelling the riots at Damascus, where there were several hundred victims. France for centuries, said the general, has played an eminent role in the Near East. A spiritual and cultural role. England, he said, had played a more special and more commercial role. When, after 1918, England obtained a mandate over Iraq, Transjordania, and Palestine, France was given a mandate over Lebanon and Syria. This mandate was not easy to carry out, he said. There were two reasons for this. The first was a local reason, a complicated reason. Whereas Egypt is a national entity, Iraq, a geographic entity, and Palestine, a geographic but not a political entity, Syria is composed of populations of different races and religions, difficult to govern. The second reason for French difficulties in her Mid-Eastern mandates was due to the British attitude, which never made things easy for the French government there, he said. There were only from 4,000 to 5,000 men in the French-controlled armed forces of Syria and Lebanon, said the general. He added later, on being questioned by a correspondent, that not one cannon, not one plane, and not one rifle in the Mideast had come out of the Lend-Lease armaments. Protesting on his affection and gratitude towards the British people, de Gaulle insisted, however, that many of the troubles in Syria and Lebanon were due to the attitude of high-ranking British officials and to the action of a large number of agents there. France, said the general, tried to reach an agreement with the two republics concerning her cultural and economical interests and concerning the obtention of bases there. The order to cease all police and military actions in Syria and Lebanon had been given on the 30th of May, said de Gaulle. The order was executed the following day, on the day Prime Minister Churchill sent his demand to the French. France was prepared to negotiate it, he insisted. And pointing out that Russia had demonstrated her interest in that region of the world, he added that the solution could no longer be a Franco-British solution, but an international agreement which would affect Orient as a whole. General de Gaulle insisted throughout the conference on the international aspect of the Mideast problem. He opined that Vichy elements which might still be in Syria and Lebanon had, in his opinion, no connection with the troubles there. General de Gaulle's press conference was followed by another conference held by Minister of Finance Plevin. The first of these press conferences will not probably affect any of our GIs over here, but the second one will, because beginning Monday, French bank bills will all have to be exchanged for a new issue. And like everyone else in this country, our GIs will have to line up at a bank teller windows to exchange their hard-earned gains. And here is Bill Chaplin to tell you about our GIs. Take it over, Bill.
Paul, what I want to tell the people at home today, it's a little story, but I think it means a lot. It's the story. It's the story of those GIs and how they do over here. I've been up in Germany for the last few weeks. I've seen a lot of the GIs in that country. Why, I was up in Berchtesgaden just last week. You know that eagle's nest way up on top of that mountain, that Hitler's eagle's nest? Well, when I finally got up there, what with my car boiling over, what with having to walk up the last hour, when I finally got up to that beautiful house in the clouds, I was both amazed and pleased. Listen, what do you think I found up there? Of course, luxury. Everything what man could want for his comfort and convenience. Chairs, divans, a fireplace with a fire burning. Now,
What would you think those GIs would do in a place like that?
Moot it, ravage it, tear it to pieces, and send little pieces home as souvenir la guerre. Let me tell you something, my friends. I sat in that great living room of Hitler's, in the Berghof, on top of that hollow mountain, and I have never been in the company of finer gentlemen in my life. They sat there, those GIs, in those overstuffed chairs, facing the blazing fire. And you could never be with nicer people. In that room where the doom of Europe, the doom of all the world, had been planned, our GIs, they sat there, and they just smoked their cigarettes and flicked the butts into the blazing fireplace. Once in a while, one of them would get up and walk to a window. In that great room, you know, there are windows on every side, and they open or close at the touch of a finger. Hitler built him that place, as any good doctor will tell you, because of a terrific inferiority complex. He felt himself so far below the ordinary run of people that he had to build a castle high above them in order to prove himself, to himself, a man. So up there we went, and there we found the GIs in command, taking it entirely in their stride. They didn't have to prove that they were men. No one would ever argue that they weren't, not after what they've done. So there they were, sitting around in Hitler's house when I was there, taking their ease and flicking their ashes in trays which had been used by Hitler and Chamberlain, Mussolini and Schuschnigg, all the appeasers and the collaborationists. Our GIs take over. I like our GIs. If there's a chance of real peace, it will be because our GIs have earned it for us.
Okay, Bill Chaplin. This is Paul Archinard in Paris, switching you now to London.
This is John McVane in London. Today's weather here is typical of England in June. Patches of blue sky, patches of cloud. Not hot enough to make you want to go swimming, not cold enough for an overcoat. This morning we had a shower. It poured for half an hour, then stopped. Incidentally, that's why so many English people carry rolled umbrellas around, no matter what the weather. You can never be certain, even when morning skies are clear, that it won't rain before noon. The police had a special warning about today. This week, for the first time in more than 3 years, ordinary civilian automobile drivers have been allowed a ration of gasoline. The authorities expected the roads would be crowded with civilian cars driven by people who'd perhaps forgotten how to drive in this long time. Pedestrians were warned they'd practically be taking their lives in their hands when they crossed the street today. All in all, the atmosphere was pretty tense. But although there are more cars on London streets today, the traffic on the open roads hasn't increased greatly. So far, no slaughter of pedestrians has been reported. The gas ration varies a little according to the horsepower of the car. For a car that'll do 20 miles to the gallon, it's about 7 gallons a month, 140 miles a month, or between 4 and 5 miles a day. Many children this week had their first ride in a car, for they weren't born when issue of gasoline to civilians was stopped entirely, and Father jacked the car up and put it on blocks in the garage. London is crowded, with returned prisoners of war and troops on leave. Around Piccadilly, you see hundreds of Australians in their broad-brimmed hats, New Zealanders and South Africans with the red stripe on their shoulders. They're forces that haven't been seen in strength in England for several years. Each one wears the Africa Star ribbon, and you know they've been prisoner in Germany since they were taken in Crete, the Western Desert, or Tunisia. It's almost impossible to get hotel rooms. When I had to move out of my apartment a few days ago, we tried 68 hotels before we got lodging. Men wearing the patches of many famous American infantry divisions are here on short leaves. After Germany, London with its clean streets and friendly crowds seems very pleasant. You can almost forget the gaps in blocks where bombs once struck. They've been tidied up. And for most American soldiers, getting back here, renewing acquaintances they made before D-Day, is the next best thing to getting home. For Londoner a soldier, it isn't easy to forget the war. Their nerves are still tightened up. You feel wound up like a spring that's grown rusty. With VE-Day, you don't immediately spring back into shape, the physical or mental relaxation you could achieve before the war. Last night, I came out in the darkness and heard a bomber droning overhead. Its riding light glowed red. That was the way we used to see them after dusk sometimes, moving in an uneven surge from London toward Berlin or Frankfurt or Bremen.
and the sound of the plane engine made you tense yourself a little as you used to do so long ago now when the planes were German planes riding high over London. A couple of days ago, I heard some distant explosion, blasting or something, I suppose, and for a second I felt tight and tense again, as I have so often in the past when the sounds were artillery or bombs or just any explosion whose cause I didn't know. I suppose everyone who's ever been around war has that feeling for a while. Certainly, it'll be something to think of and allow for when your own men get back home from combat. It'll take some understanding to realize that even though their bodies are unmarked by any wound, they'll have mental scars. They'll perhaps act in ways that will seem strange to you. It'll take time and care to smooth out the scars that exposure to danger and fear have left on them. The spring that is their inner being will still be rusty for a while. The British people in general are just beginning to get used to the idea that a terrible and important war is being fought out in the Far East. They've been so near to the European wars, the Pacific seemed far, far away. A documentary film, Report on Burma, is now playing in the big London movie houses. It's giving Britain a new idea of the hardships their own men have been undergoing in the Burma campaign. A few men of the British 14th Army are back on leave after several years abroad, though a 14th Army major told me he hadn't found anyone yet who recognized the 14th Army patch on his shoulder. He tells of the difficulties the British troops had to endure, life for weeks and nothing but K-rations after the big airborne landing, the daily life in the rain-swept jungle, the difficulty of evacuating wounded, nobody moving from dusk to dawn in a country where there are no passwords and you just shoot anything that moves at night. The families of such men are learning about the war in the East, and now, with most British soldiers wondering whether they'll be sent to Mountbatten, interest in general is increasing. The chief interest in radio and press in recent days has been concentrated on the problem of Syria. The fighting created one of those passing waves of anti-French irritation that I suppose have been common in Britain since the days of Julius Caesar. Commentators, officials, and the general public approved Mr. Churchill's brusque note to General de Gaulle, as well as the sending in of British troops. Only a rare few have been able to see the danger to Anglo-French relations or seen anything out of the ordinary in the way the matter was handled. Yet if Syria had been Palestine or India, and some other country had stepped in similar circumstances, the British would have reacted in about 2 seconds. Now they're surprised at French irritation. I suppose nations, like individuals, get their nerves wound up tight by a long and exhausting war. They, too, find it hard to think and act normally immediately afterward. For guidance, one well-informed Scotsman told me yesterday he was going to dig out the books he had right after the last war and find out what they had to say when among the chief problems were Syria and Trieste. I return you now to the United States.
Now some news from other sections of the world. General Charles de Gaulle of France has answered the British in the Levant crisis. At a press conference today, de Gaulle charges Britain with using agents to encroach on French interests in the Middle East and of violating a 4-year-old treaty regarding Syria and Lebanon. De Gaulle's statement, more a stiff criticism than a denunciation, said that France is willing to discuss the future of the entire Arab world with other powers, but not the status of its Levant protectorate alone. The French government chief contended that the shooting indulged in by French troops in the Levant this week was an act of defense, with only one plane used against Damascus. And he said British military strength in the Middle East far exceeds that of France. Today, the British Army and Navy are in control at Beirut, Damascus, and elsewhere in the Lebanon and Syria. London is the center of settlement efforts, which Britain, this country, and Russia say must be peaceably found. In the Pacific, Admiral Halsey's Third Fleet has returned to the action, with the Japs reporting carrier raids on southern Japan. Admiral Spruance of the Fifth Fleet returns to Guam after 5 action-filled months. That's the War Telescope for today. This afternoon, you heard from Paul Archinard, W.W. Chaplin, and John McVane. War Telescope is presented over the network of the National Broadcasting Company.